From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake is here to talk about her priorities in her remaining time leading the city, her reflections on the last 5 years, including her handling of April's uprising, what she worries may be left undone, and how she decided not to run for another term.
It was a very difficult decision, but I knew that I needed to spend time, the remaining 15 months of my term, focused on the city's future and not my own.
Then the Lomax Project takes the stage tonight at the Creative Alliance in East Baltimore, playing an eclectic mix of world and folk music. Tom Hall has a preview. And a Baltimore story from Gil Sandler. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. It's been just a week since Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake stunned the city by taking herself out of contention for re-election. 5.5 years after she became mayor, when an ethics scandal swept her predecessor Sheila Dixon out of office, Mayor Rawlings Blake said she felt every minute she spent campaigning was pulling her away from working for the city she loves. But she has found time to keep her promise to talk with us this morning, and we're very glad she's here with us. Welcome back to the show.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here.
Just a couple days after you stopped campaigning, you spelled out four priorities for your remaining 15 months in office. What's the most important to you?
I think the thing about being mayor of a large city is you have to juggle multiple urgent priorities. So to say the most, we have to continue to move forward on all fronts. I'm very committed to cooperating with the Department of Justice Patterns and Practice investigation to ensure that we continue to do the work to reform the Baltimore City Police Department. I'm very focused on making sure the city gets through these six trials. I know that it's not going to be easy. We saw just two motions hearings, how that impacted the city from a safety and preparedness to the concern from businesses and residents. So there's a lot of work to do. We're going to continue to grow jobs in our city and focus on those hardest to employ individuals. We've made a lot of progress reducing unemployment by a third, creating over 12,000 jobs, but there's a lot more work to do.
One of the other priorities that you mentioned to the Baltimore Sun is rec centers, recreation centers, and
pools. Oh, absolutely,
pools.
Yeah.
You've been across purposes with the city council president, Jack Young, about how to pay for refurbishing rec centers. You want to sell city-owned parking lots. He says that they are a steady source of revenue, and instead the city should sell the Hilton Hotel that it's owned. Do you see, in the position you are in now, do you see that stalemate getting solved more easily than it has so far?
I think the only way it's going to get solved is when the public's voice is heard. You know, the council president has been a vocal proponent of more recreation for our young people. He was, even though he voted to close PAL centers under the previous administration, he admonished me for doing the tough work of closing old and underutilized rec centers so we could put ourselves in the position to build more. Now, when we are suggesting that we have a plan to build more, he's standing in the way. And unless the public speaks out, I don't think there's going to be a change in the stalemate. To suggest that we sell a hotel, he's on the hotel board, the Hilton Hotel board. He understands very clearly that if we sell the hotel, it is at a loss. You can't build anything when you take a hit on the cost. So he's not even suggesting that we put money on the table. He's suggesting that we use a stream of revenue from parking garages when it's clear that it's the stream of revenue would not support the $132 million of capital expenditures that we're trying to move forward. We need to put real dollars on the table. And selling the garages does that. It will give us between $40 to $60 million. And until the council president or anyone on the city council has another suggestion for how to put that amount of money on the table, they should at least hear the bill, the thought that the public is standing by and watching as the council president and the leadership of the council stands in the way of progress when it comes to our recreation centers is shameful to me.
How does the dynamic of that work out differently now that you are not running for re-election, especially since several council members are? Does that...
I don't know what the dynamic is. You know, I'm going to continue to push, but the facts remain the facts. You know, I've been very vocal proponent of moving forward with this capital plan to bring top quality recreation centers and pools, indoor and outdoor pools to our city for months and months and months. I can't be the only one talking. I think the council president and particularly Carl Stokes, who chairs the committee that's been sitting on this bill, I don't even know how long. You know, I think that the public needs to be clear that the bill deserves a hearing, and that the community deserves to have access to the resources to build to continue to build top quality recreation centers in our city.
That's Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake here on Maryland Morning WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her priorities now that she's not running for re-election as mayor. There had been so much reporting during the rioting, after the rioting in April, of friction between you and Governor Hogan that a lot of us took note last Friday when he issued a statement praising your decision, but saying that he values his working relationship with you, because that wasn't obvious to us that that working relationship was something that he valued. And then yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford said pretty much what you had said a week ago, that your decision sort of hits a reset button. The lieutenant governor said, quote, Mayor Rawlings Blake's decision to not run actually frees her to work with us to do some really good things in Baltimore. It frees her up from the political back and forth, worrying what this group is saying, what she's going to hear from the national party, close quote. Explain that to the non-politicians among us.
I think you have to get him to explain his quote. I mean, that's not why I'm here.
I'm not to
move the city forward.
I'm sorry. I thought he was essentially saying, making the same point that you had made last week.
He's talking about freeing me up from the national party, and that never entered my mind. You know, for me, to his point about working together, you know, while I think much has been made of much has been exaggerated about any friction between me and Governor Hogan. The governor's been clear that he wants to work with me. I've been clear that I want to work with him. We're not going to agree on everything. We knew that going in. There were policies and principles that he ran on that I was against. So we knew that we were going to have challenges, but. I've said consistently that I will work with him to continue to move Baltimore forward. We had a great meeting yesterday, a one-on-one meeting yesterday, to talk about some of the things that we can do together over the next 15 months. And I'm going to continue to work hard to be an advocate for my city and to work with Governor Hogan and anyone and everyone who has the capacity to move us forward and the desire to see Baltimore continue to progress.
There are those, I'm sure you have heard, who say that the decisions Governor Hogan has made affecting Baltimore in recent months, particularly the red line, the somewhat unilateral approach to shutting down the men's detention center, his approach to funding, to rebuilding liquor stores in the neighborhoods damaged by riots, in neighborhoods where you have said clearly liquor stores are not needed, that many of these decisions look like he's made the decision he wins politically if Baltimore loses. I mean, there are critics who talk about a war on Baltimore. How do you see it?
As I said before, we're not going to agree on everything. I think that it doesn't benefit Baltimore, however, to just focus on those areas where we don't agree. I think there are several areas where we agree that more investment is necessary, and I'm committed to working with the governor on those things to move forward. He's not going to change my mind about the red line. I'm not going to change his mind about the red line. But even during that time where we disagreed about the red line, I was very clear that I remain optimistic about a working relationship with his administration to move Baltimore forward, and that's what I'm going to focus on.
What is your red line strategy? Do you have any plans to try to undo it, his decision?
We continue to await response from the Hogan administration. They said at the red line meeting that they had been working on alternatives to strengthen public transportation in the city, and I'm looking forward to seeing those.
The ball's in his court. You're not coming up with an alternative.
By constitution, the state Maryland state constitution puts the onus of developing mass transit or public transportation in the transportation authority, the Maryland, Department of Transportation. Excuse me.
And getting back to your comments about the U.S. Department of Justice review of the police department. Mm-hmm. Tell me what the governor's, I'm sorry, I'm interested in what the mayor's role will be in that. I mean, it seemed to me to be something that we're waiting for the U.S. Justice Department. It's one of your top priorities. Yeah. So tell me more about what that means.
There's an entity that is responsible for the investigation, and there is an entity that is responsible for responding. And as the respondent, I'm working very hard with the police department to make sure all of the information that they need, the Department of Justice needs, to be able to do that, the portion of the investigation that deals with the police department or any dealings with the city, that we are eager and willing partners. More times than not, when a pattern in practice investigation is conducted by the Department of Justice, it is not with the I don't know of any other mayor that has invited that investigation in. So we're on new territory there. But even when the majority of these investigations happen without the cooperation of the jurisdiction that is being investigated, that's not happening here. I made it very, very clear that I want to cooperate. I want to get to the bottom of the issues that are that continue to damage the relationship between the community and the police. I want to get to the bottom of the issues that make our residents feel that the police and the public are on different playing fields. I want to continue the work with urgency of reforming the police department, and I believe the cooperation with the Patterson Practice investigation is the best way to get us there.
The priority you articulated of attracting jobs to the city, I mean, is that sort of another way of restating your goal of attracting 10,000 families to the city?
In order to attract 10,000 families, Baltimore has to be a vibrant city, has to be a safe city. I chose that overarching goal for the city because it was very forward-looking. So we had to, I knew that in order to reach that goal, we had to do things like reduce unemployment and improve Baltimore's business climate. We had to focus on safety. We have to focus on building new schools. Baltimore had the oldest schools in the state. So that overarching goal of bringing families to the city allowed us to work on multiple fronts to move the city forward.
And where are you in that goal of 10,000 new families?
Yeah, it is. There are some organizations that are counting. I'm not, keeping track of one by one. I get excited when people come up to me. I'm one of your 10,000 families. It's more of a movement than a data-driven approach to, this is our 10th family, 11th family, that sort of thing. It's more of a way of looking at the way that we conduct business in the city to promote growth and vitality.
Well, okay. The number I had seen, and there may be other numbers, is 2,000 individuals, which presumably is a smaller number of families. And it makes me wonder how much was the damage to Baltimore's brand by what happened in April, by the the writing in particular? How much of a setback?
It was definitely a setback. Businesses have been hurt. Institutions have been hurt. Tourism have been hurt. What hasn't been hurt, however, is home values and the purchase of homes. There are only two jurisdictions in the state that had increase in home values over the past few months. It was Baltimore City and Harford County. If you take a look at the purchase of homes, I think it was July to September this year over last year, there's an increase in the number of transactions for home purchase. So those two indicators lead me to believe that people are still bullish on our city. We still continue to have announcements of businesses that are moving into Baltimore, businesses who are interested in Baltimore, that have decided to move forward with their investment. So, yes, we took a hit. But the story isn't all bad. There's still a lot of people that are bullish on Baltimore.
We asked listeners what questions they wanted you to answer. Bridget of Baltimore wrote us, quote, "I would like to know if, looking back now in hindsight, if there is anything the mayor wishes she had done differently on the night of the riots," close quote.
I think I've talked about that enough. I'm looking forward.
Okay. As I said, we ask listeners, and that's on the minds of people.
That's my answer.
City schools. You told the Baltimore Sun that overseeing the $1 billion investment in renovating city schools is one of the top things you're focusing on.
Not overseeing. Baltimore City is a partner in the 21st century school plan. So working to make sure that we're leveraging every single dollar of that investment to strengthen our neighborhood. I announced the Inspire program, which is run out of the planning department. It's a collaboration across agencies of my administration to make sure that as we prepare for these investments, the Department of Transportation is on board with doing the work that's necessary on the roads. Housing is on board to do the work and to direct investment in those communities. Recreation is on board to make sure that the web of recreational opportunities for our young people includes these new school facilities. So it's certainly not directing, but a strong partner in making sure that we do our part to get it right.
And the timeline of that, how much of that will fall during your administration? How much? I mean, that's it's a multi-year rollout, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's a multi-year rollout, and this is the first phase of hopefully multiple phases of school construction, and there's a lot of critical work in the preliminary phases of development of this plan, and that will guide our ability to get to a phase two or a phase three. That's why this work is so critical. We want to make sure that there is significant community input. We want to make sure that that every dollar spent during this process, that the city's accountable, the school system's accountable, Maryland Stadium Authority, that we're getting this right. And that will be my focus over the next 15 months.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, talking about what she is focusing on in her last 15 months in office. The city school CEO is coming under some criticism. I was struck by a piece in the Baltimore Sun with some fairly candid criticism from members of the school board saying they were disappointed in his performance so far. How do you look at the city school CEO, Gregory Thornton?
There are some challenging jobs in cities. Being the mayor's one, being the police commissioner's one, being the in charge of schools is one as well. It's very, when you compare the two, when you think about the police department and the commissioner fighting for reform at the same time he's expected to support the officers, that's a tough position, a tough balancing act to be. And the school CEO is in no different position. He understands it. He needs to push for reform, whether it's in health care, whether it's in the way that the school system conducts its business. When you want to change and to change the way that teachers have been operating, or principals or administrators have been operating for decades, you're going to meet with some resistance. And it's a delicate balancing act, and it's ripe for the type of criticism that he's under, because it's a tough position to be in. I know that Dr. Thornton cares about Baltimore's kids. I know he also cares about making our school system more the budget more accountable, the leadership more accountable, and he's going to continue to push for the things that he believes is are right to make sure that we're focused on our kids.
So you think he's on the right track?
Every time I've had conversations with Dr. Thornton, we've been on the same page with the goals and the things that he's pushing for in the classroom, as well as with reforms in the operations of the school system. He's doing some of the things that I did as a part of the 10-year financial plan. When we did the 10-year financial plan, one of the things was an audit of the health system that had not been done. And what we found is, tens of millions of dollars that were going to people who were ineligible for health insurance, but no one had ever checked to see if a child had aged out, or, someone was divorced and we're still paying for their ex-husband's health insurance. You know, a lot of people benefit when a lot of people have received the benefit of leadership not paying attention to those details. It's not the sexy stuff, but it's the stuff that makes the school system stronger, and certainly made our budget stronger. We've had the highest bond rating the city's had in over 50 years, and he's doing those same things in the school system. Does it ruffle feathers? Absolutely it does. Does it lead to criticism? Absolutely it does. But if you want to see progress, sometimes it's a little uncomfortable.
You are not running for re-election, but are you out of politics? And I've got two questions. One is, are you not going to take any role in the mayoral campaign? Do you envision at some point endorsing? Do you expect to be campaigning for somebody else?
No.
So you don't anticipate taking any role?
I do not anticipate taking any role in the mayoral primary.
And then,
out of politics? No, I'm still secretary of the DNC, very active nationally in politics, and very well respected around the country as a Democratic leader.
And president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors this year. So when you look ahead, what in politics interests you?
When I look ahead, I see 15 months of working very hard for my city every single day to push for progress. I've been driven by my desire to make Baltimore better since I was in elementary school, and I have had the incredible opportunity of moving Baltimore forward in ways that I think are amazing, dealing with challenges that most administrations don't challenge, structural budget deficits, reforming the police department, a comprehensive plan, the most comprehensive plan the city's had in more than 20 years to deal with vacant properties. We've done a lot of great stuff, and I'm focused on getting that done.
You were already serving on the city council in the 90s when Martin O'Malley was mayor, so you had a close-up view of his policing policies. As you know better than I, there are lots of people now pointing to the heavy reliance on arrests for relatively small offenses during that period as a source of tension between the community and police. How does that analysis look to you? Do you think that when he argues that's what the community wanted then, that brought crime down, that was the right set of policies?
I'm
wondering what you think today.
I think to say that's what the community wanted, I was there. We were there during that campaign. He was very clear about his policing strategy during the election, and he won with more than 50% of the vote, I think. So, to say he ran on that platform, I don't think you can question that. I think the things that have changed in the interim is policing strategies, which are fluid, which are not stagnant. Policing policies, research around policing strategies, they change year to year, decade to decade. During that time, Baltimore was one of many cities that had looked at the broken window theory of policing, where that there needed to be increased enforcement to hit the reset button in many communities and bring law and order back to many communities. And while that was a strategy that reduced crime, it also came at a cost. And because of those costs, Baltimore and many other cities around the country changed the policy to focus on violent repeat offenders. And I'm sure 5 years from now, people will be looking at the strategies that we've employed and be talking about some other strategies that are the prevailing thought of that day. Strategies change.
What do you want your legacy to be seen? Excuse me. How do you want your legacy to be defined?
I'm focused on doing the work, not pontificating about a potential legacy.
It just seems like when you set a time limit on yourself, as you have by saying you're not going to run again.
Only on my job as mayor, not on my life. You know, hopefully God will give me long life and my legacy will, part of my legacy will be my time as mayor. But, you know, at 45, I pray that I have a long time to think about what my legacy will be.
I do too. Are there any fights that you feel like you're walking away from, that you're not taking on?
No, I mean, I'll say this. The only thing I'm walking away from is the election. We have some significant fights. We've talked about them, whether it's police reform or moving forward with the rec center capital plan. We got a lot of fights ahead of us, and I'm looking forward to them because I know that by making the tough decisions as I have throughout my time as mayor, and by continuing to focus on good policy and not good what's good politics or what's popular, I have moved our city forward. I'm going to continue to do that for the next 15 months.
One of the questions that was raised a week ago and it was whether you will be able to keep a good staff around you since your time is limited. We saw just in the last 24 hours that your spokesman Kevin Harris is moving to another job with the Peace Corps in Washington. What is your strategy to be sure that you have a good team with you all through these 15 months?
I think there are a lot of people who care deeply about our city at this very critical time. And, the fact, I mean, at the end of the day, there's always transition. There's always people that come. There's always people that go in government, in any administration. I will continue to work with and to look for those individuals who have the capacity to move us forward and have the drive to work for Baltimore at a time when we need people the most. And that is attractive to, that opportunity is attractive to many people.
We've heard in the public reporting of your decision, many people who have been critics saying this was a good decision, praising you for that. What are you hearing privately? I mean, are you hearing a lot of regret from people who wish that you were doing both, governing and politicking?
I have heard it all. I mean, you know, I was just in Remington this morning, and one of the community members that was on the crime and grime walk at every other corner would say, "I think you should reconsider. I think you should reconsider." The decision was a challenging one to reach, but once I reached it, I'm very firm in my conviction that it's the right thing to do. I know that it is a change. I know that people in communities like Remington who have seen the transformation over the last 5 years, they have a lot of reasons to. I know he has a lot of reason to say what he said, that he'd like me to continue because he wants Remington to continue to thrive. But you know what I committed to do was to leave the city in a better condition than it was left for me when I became mayor, and I'm going to continue to work every single day to make sure that in Remington and other neighborhoods throughout the city that holds true.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake. This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Alan Lomax was a folklorist who was one of the first people to record and document music from a variety of folk traditions. Tonight at the Creative Alliance, a group called Jamie Stone's Lomax Project will perform some of the music discovered by Alan Lomax. Here's a cut from their latest CD. This is called I Want to Hear Somebody Pray.
I want to hear somebody pray.
Margaret Glaspie singing with Jamie Stone's Lomax Project. Jamie Stone joins me in this studio. Good morning. It's great to meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
So you're focusing on these songs that were collected by this guy, Alan Lomax. Tell us a little bit more about Mr. Lomax. He was really quite a pivotal figure in the history of folk and world music here in the United States.
Very much so. So if you picture yourself in 1933, Alan Lomax was 17 years old, and his father, John Avery Lomax, Texan with a big hat and swagger, and was going out into the field, bringing his then 17-year-old son with him through the rural South, largely visiting penitentiaries at first, with a brand new Edison acetate disc cutter, which was the latest in quote-unquote portable recording technology, this big 300-pound thing. They had retrofitted their Model T Ford to house.
This was no Sony Walkman, was it?
No, not a bit. And I needed all this equipment, and it was constantly breaking down. You know, you can read letters back and forth to the Library of Congress, you know, trying to get parts and figure out how to. Anyway, Alan got the bug early and began a career of making field recordings, which continued for the next 60 years. He recorded over 30,000 songs, and he was really interested in what he liked to call music with the bark still on it. You know, the kind of rough-hewn, homemade, handmade folk music that people, you know, mostly made for their own enjoyment. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to share and preserve that with the world.
So for your band, have you made a study then of what Mr. Lomax collected, and you picked and chosen things from that vast repertoire that you wanted to give a new take to?
Exactly. Yeah, the idea of the project is to take these old songs and then breathe new life into them. Some are ones that lots of folks will know, and many others we wanted to find things that were new discoveries in the far corners of the archive that were just gathering dust and make new arrangements of it and use the songs as raw material for our own creative process rather than feel like we need to preserve them because they've already been preserved.
Here's a tune called Before This Time, Another Year.
Before this time, another year, I might be gone in some lonesome graveyard. Oh, Lordy, how long before I go?
How long?
Well, I'd like to know
how
many more days.
And I guess Alan Lomax actually wrote this tune himself, right? Is that right?
Or a different one we did. This one's actually a traditional spiritual from the Georgia Sea Islands.
Uh-huh.
That was sung by a woman named Bessie Jones.
Because I was thinking, if he wrote it, it was like certainly in the style of a spiritual.
Right. Do one tune that he wrote, and it was kind of an interesting one because it sounded so traditional. And everyone I played it for was like, yeah, but I've never heard this. And we looked up lyrics and all that stuff.
Original composition in 1960 or something.
Yeah, and finally discovered that he'd written it.
So, stylistically, this is all over the map then. I mean, this is on your record. I mean, so you're from spirituals to folk music to bluegrass. I mean, you really cover all the bases, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, the archive itself is so diverse. And even on one field collecting trip, you know, in one state, he would visit, you know, African-American cultures over here and you know, white folk singers over here, and go record at a church and a schoolyard and a penitentiary. And so he was really covering a lot of ground. And so there's 15 musicians on the record and even more that are sort of part of the larger community of the project. And so I wanted to capture the diversity, lots of different singers coming in and out, and to try and, as best we could, give a little taste of the diversity of the collection itself.
Oh, Shenandoah, I long to see you.
It's haunting and beautiful. Again, Margaret Glaspie, the vocalist, and she'll be with you tonight at the Creative Alliance. Mm-hmm. When you have a tune like Shenandoah, which is probably one of the most recognizable songs, you know, in the world, you have an urge to do a new take on it, right? And do you do this research to inform the way you arrange these sometimes very well-known songs?
Yeah, and every song was really different. You know, a lot of the arrangements were done in collaboration, and we never decided, you know, that we would treat this one like this, or, you know, there are some that we'd listened to and it felt like there was nothing that needed to be added or taken away. It was just perfect as it was, and we tried to be faithful to the original recording. And other things we would completely reimagine, like Shenandoah, is this epic 6-minute piece on the recording, and it just swells to great heights almost orchestrally, and that was a piece partly because I knew that people would know it. I wanted to kind of bring something new to offer the piece.
It's a great effect, that drone in the beginning, you know, it really winds it up, and as you say, it unfolds over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How many folks will you have playing with you tonight? I know you had a total of 15 or so working on the album, but how many are you touring with?
Yeah, we're touring as a quartet. So myself, I play banjo and sing, and then Margaret Glaspie sings and plays guitar. She's an amazing vocalist and songwriter from New York.
As we've heard this morning, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sumaya Jackson plays the fiddle, and Andrew Downing's playing the double bass.
Jamie Stone, he leads the Lomax Project. They'll be performing tonight at the Creative Alliance at 8 o'clock. We've got a link to information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Really great to meet you. Thanks a lot, and break a leg tonight.
Okay, thanks.
That's it for us today. Join us Monday morning when I'll talk with Scott Shane of the New York Times about his new book. It's an examination of the U.S. strategy of drone warfare and the consequences for our war on terrorism and on personal liberties. That's coming up Monday morning on Maryland Morning. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnny McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. In this month in Maryland history, 1727, publisher William Park started the newspaper Maryland Gazette in Annapolis. Its second publisher, Jonas Green, suspended publication in 1765 rather than pay Great Britain's hated stamp tax. After Green's death 2 years later, his wife, Anne Catherine Hoof Green, became the first female publisher in America. The descendant of the Gazette was bought last year by the Baltimore Sun Media Group. We're publishing again Monday. Please join us.